episode 304 of the Pilot Podcast takes off now. Fly with Garmin Avionics, then grab your mobile device and make the Garmin Pilot app your cockpit companion. Get advanced functions you'll use before, during, and after every flight, including updating your aircraft's databases and logging engine data. Plan, file, fly, log with Garmin Pilot.
The Pilot to Pilot Podcast is brought to you by Learn the Finer Points. Use the link below to save 10% off their ground school app.
All pilots like to have the big weather picture when they're flying, and that's why I use SiriusXM Aviation. I moto check things like fronts, air mets, sigmets, turbulence, pyreps, and more while I'm pre-flighting and while I'm en route. This gives me and my passengers the most comfortable flying experience. And now with the latest offer from SiriusXM, there's never a better time to upgrade your next flight with the Garmin GDL52 portable receiver to bring SiriusXM and ADS-B weather plus traffic into your cockpit. SiriusXM Aviation is offering a $400 rebate on new receivers purchased by July 31st. The GDL52 is compatible with Garmin Pilot and 4Flight. Take advantage of this great offer and fly with the weather I count on for every flight. To learn more, visit sporties.com/SXM offer. That's sporties.com/SXM offer.
Jim Higgins, Professor of Aviation, University of North Dakota.
Aviation, what is going on? And welcome back to the Pilot Podcast. My name is Justin Seams, and I am your host. Today's episode is a state of the industry, and as you will know, it is a little bit behind of what the news that has come out recently with UPS hiring 300 pilots and with Spirit deciding to furlough 260 pilots and downgrade 130 captains with the possibility of more furloughs on the way. Jim and I didn't get a chance to talk about this because we interviewed this last week, and as we mentioned these episodes, things are changing so fast. I am currently on the road. It is day three. Wasn't able to get Jim on the phone or on the radio, I should say, or Skype. We're not doing radio, but I wasn't able to get a time to record this, so we're going to release the episode as is, but with the caveat of remembering that Spirit is furloughing 260 pilots. There are going to be downgrades of 130 captains with the possibility of 130 downgrades in the future and more furloughs as well. So Jim and I will have another episode coming out here soon. If you are a Spirit pilot, my condolences. I am so sorry. I don't know what it's like to be furloughed. I wish you the best. Send me an email. I will try to help in any way I can to write a letter of recommendations or to just brainstorm. So send me an email, justin@pilottopilothq.com. I don't know how much help I can be, but you never know. Aviation, I hope you enjoy the state of the industry as Jim and I love talking about these. It is a lot of fun, and just a lot of good information comes out of these. So thank you so much. I appreciate it. And if you do have any other questions for Jim and I, you can also email those questions to justin@pilottopilothq.com. So without any further ado, here's State of the Industry with Jim Higgins. Aviation, what is going on? Welcome back to a State of the Industry episode. We have everyone's favorite, Dr. Jim Higgins. He is on here to share all of his knowledge, the wealth of knowledge that he has, which continues to grow by the day. He was just texting me the other day, all these news articles, and we're like, all right, we need to do another one. So let's come on and do one. So we are, 9:16 p.m. Eastern time on mine. It's 8:16 over by you. On Central Time, which I miss sometimes, especially right now. We're recording at 9:30 almost. Right. But, we get them out when we can. And it's important to get these out. We both talked about doing this more regularly. Wow, I can't talk today. It is going to be a rough one. But we'll get them out more because every day it seems like something else is going on. Wouldn't you agree?
No, yeah, absolutely. It really does seem. All you have to do is just have a Google News feed and set it to airlines. And you'll get alerts continually and just things we don't see very often. I mean, of course, we see all the normal stuff, different route expansions, different airlines looking at different things. But we're seeing things we saw. Was it Delta put in a notice to leave their alliance, which is something you just don't see? I mean, that goes against that. We've seen, the FedEx losing out on their USPS. We've seen some, ETOPS issues. You and I were talking about that. And then, of course, some Pratt & Whitney and then the ongoing Boeing stuff. So there's all kinds of things going on right now. And then, of course, ALPA has been very strong on the no pilot shortage bandwagon. So lots of things to talk about.
Absolutely, which is crazy because we just recorded one what feels like a week ago. Right. And we have an hour's worth of stuff that we could talk about. Yep. I think the most important one to start off with and just the one that continues to shock me day by day and hour by hour is just what's going on at FedEx. Since we've talked, you know, there's always been kind of these rumors of FedEx isn't doing as well. The union and the company, they're in a pretty really fierce battle. And I always thought, and it was kind of told by the people that I know at FedEx. Now, I don't know any higher ups. I just know some pilots who think they know a lot. So no offense to them. But they were telling me that it's a lot of posturing by the company. And it seems to be turning out that that is not the case, especially with them losing the USPS contract. Now, I was on some forums, which, as everyone knows, that is a terrible place to get good knowledge and good information. But they were trying to say, make all the excuses in the world that it's not the end of the world. It's the, they just didn't want to operate with what USPS was willing to pay and said that FedEx was going to be losing money. But it just seems like a very, very big contract to lose out on, especially since the struggles they've had with Amazon coming into the game and just what's been they've been dealing with in the last couple of years. So please tell me what you know and we can kind of go from there.
Yeah, it is very interesting how things are playing out at FedEx. Of course, you can go back pre-pandemic and, you know, they were a big Amazon carrier, right? And then Amazon, I don't know, they either pulled the contract or again, FedEx may have left the contract. It depends on who you talk to. Yeah. But, you know, the thought process was that was going to be a 5-7% contraction at FedEx, you know, and their freight, you know, so that would have had a big hit. Of course, COVID happened, pandemic happened, and we all know that had a bouncing effect with the cargo carriers, including, you know, FedEx, and they all did very well. And a lot of planes that they were going to park, they kept in service, you know, and they grew and they hired and they had some banner years throughout the pandemic. And now we're on the other side of it. We're emerging. We're seeing more of a stabilization in freight and, you know, freight tons carried. That's their one of their metrics is FTMs instead of ASMs. And so we're seeing that. But then now comes this news that USPS is no longer going to use them to do their second day air and their, you know, their overnight stuff. So that's really interesting. And again, I'm sure the margins on the USPS probably aren't as good as their normal margins are on some of their other stuff. They can't control that as much because it's all probably controlled by contract. Nonetheless, it's a pretty serious development. You know, we've seen them lose Amazon. We've seen them lose USPS. We know that they're probably, well, they've stopped their hiring, of course. So that's another indication of, you know, where they're at. And so it'll be pretty interesting to see how it plays out. I am concerned. I also have good friends there at FedEx, a lot of good people there. One of the rumors is when FedEx did their layoffs of all the, not pilots, none of the pilots were furloughed, but when they did, they had a pretty big massive layoff a couple weeks ago. And, the rumor is, and you know, it's like you said, rumors, sometimes there's a element of truth to them. Sometimes it's not at all. But the rumor was if FedEx didn't have such a good furlough protection provision or provisions in their contract, that they may have even touched some of the pilots, which, you know, would just be unbelievable in this current environment to actually be talking the F word again, the furlough word. So I don't know. We'll see what happens. They are certainly having their labor issues. You know, the MEC has to be released for mediation, which, of course, begins a 30-day cooling off period, which, of course, at the end of that 30 days can lead to a strike or some other type of self-help. Now, the NMB, my guess, just knowing what I know as a student of labor history, they're unlikely anytime soon to start that 30-day period, and that is the NMB's call. But it is interesting that the union feels they're there, you know. So yeah, it's just something we're gonna have to monitor.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, it's crazy. It just seems like it's one hit after the other. And running a business, losing your two biggest clients, I assume this would be your two biggest clients, has to be bad for business. Like there's no way to sugarcoat losing both of those. Do you think, I mean, I know the pausing for hiring at American, United, even a slowdown at some other airlines has to do with what Boeing is going on. But do you think there also could be like a wait and see going on with maybe what's going to go on with Spirit? What's going to go on with FedEx? There might be some very highly qualified 121 pilots out there that have the opportunity to come fly for us. We know their experience. We know they've been trained 121. We know that they can do this job. Do you think that comes into the picture at all? I know they're hiring for like, what is it? Usually they hire like 8 months in advance for what they project that they're going to need 8 months or up to a year. Do you think there's any case that this is kind of coming into it at all?
Well, I mean, certainly there are some aircraft shortages, right? And that's just in the supply chain from Boeing. And that's been, we've talked about this before. It's pretty well documented. I don't know. I do. My feeling is a company posturing to be tough on labor? No, I don't think so. I mean, the only thing that gives me pause is with that massive layoff, they also did do a very large stock buyback.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of says, well, you know, then, you know, did you have to? I don't know. I mean, it's just it all goes to how philosophically one runs a business, I guess. But yeah. That being said, it does feel to me to be a little more systemic there. You know, the fundamentals for freight, which by the way, have typically preceded a downturn in the economy. When you go back historically, freight's one of the early ones to you start seeing some pressure on that. Some have even said it's a fairly decent leading economic indicator of downturns. And so we are seeing some softening there. I mean, long term, I think the forecast is still good. I mean, people are going to move goods and services long term, and FedEx will always be a primary player there. Are they going to grow as fast as they want? Maybe not. I think there might be a few more systemic issues there. Again, though, you know, no one has a crystal ball, and we'll have to see how it plays out. I do know if you're a junior person at FedEx, you're probably going to be in your position for a while, until hiring resumes or the market picks back up. And that's something you can mentally prepare for.
And we've heard this before a lot. We've heard how the freight industry can kind of be a precursor, a preteller to what's going to go on with the economy. But I almost wonder if that's kind of, this isn't any disrespect to FedEx at all, but if that has kind of moved off of what FedEx is right now, because everyone orders off Amazon, right? Like, I mean, I ship FedEx every once in a while, but predominantly my stuff is going to be Amazon. And I'd imagine that once Amazon carriers slow down, that is going to be a true tell of what is going on with the economy, because I don't know. I feel like that FedEx and UPS were the big two, right? And now you got everything Amazon's doing and just taking over and continually to hurt both of those companies with their power that they have and that they keep gaining.
Right. No, I think that's right. I also think that we have to also look at what's going on in Asia. You know, there's been some softening in the Chinese markets, which have historically been very strong for shipping. We all know about how many goods and services are produced over there and are sent here to the U.S. And a large component of that involves air freight. You know, not all of it's on shipping a lot of it does come on air freight. So we've seen some softening there, and that even a small move there can have a dramatic impact, you know, on all the freight carriers worldwide. So, yeah, you know, I don't know. It does seem like we're in a little bit of a shakedown, you know, or shakeup, I guess. The other piece is the airline industry in general is a leading economic indicator of a downturn and a lagging economic indicator of an upturn, which is sad, right? Because it compresses our prosperity, our business cycles are compressed compared to other industries. We're not seeing that so much on the passenger side anymore because of the ancillary income, which we've talked about before, and the ways airlines make money now. But we certainly, you know, the freight carriers can't really do the same thing, right? I mean, an airline can charge for a baggage fee or a seat convenience fee or first on. You know, there's certain things we're experimenting with on the freight side. You know, if you want to get it there before 8 a.m., you know, you can pay a little more or whatever. So you're seeing some of that ancillary type of income, but they don't have the opportunity just structurally that you'll see on the passenger side. And so, yeah, I do think we need to fasten our seatbelt for at least a little while. And I don't think, you know, FedEx is not in danger of being insolvent by any stretch. They're going to be a major player for years to come. From a pilot perspective, I think you can anticipate a little bit slow movement for a while, but eventually that'll pick back up just like all the other airlines, especially when retirements, you know, kick in and the other fundamentals start, you know, reaching where they're forecast to be.
Yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned ancillary fees, right? Ancillary. Yeah. Ancillary.
Yeah. Fancy word.
I'm glad you brought that up because American just changed how much they're charging for bags. It seems to be another hot topic. We talked before about how I think it was in the pandemic and on when they stopped all the change fees, all the cancellation fees. Do you foresee the raise in a baggage fee as a to kind of test in the waters to see how the consumers respond, to see if it's strong? And if it is, they're going to come back with all the other fees on top of that?
Yes. The truth is the market is borne out as much as the consumers complain about these fees, whatever they are, baggage fees, carry-on fees, any type of convenience fees, change fees. There's a number of different types of ancillary fees that can go in there. It really does not affect a person's decision to travel or not. And it's not even a competitive variable. You know, you would think, okay, if I'm going to travel on American from Dallas to Chicago, right, from hub to hub, but I can also look at United, even though Dallas isn't one of their hubs, Chicago certainly is. okay, so my base ticket might be a little bit more on one or the other, but that's where the passenger ends up stopping their analysis. I mean, the studies are very clear on this. They don't look and say, oh, but you know, I'm going to bring a bag. I mean, they might mention it, but it doesn't seem to be directly affecting that. So Wall Street and the analysts on Wall Street will tell you that they think the airline should be doing a lot more. And recently, of course, United's been criticized for not bringing back their change fees. You know, they've kept the pandemic, you know, no change fee. And a lot of people think they're leaving a lot of money, you know, on the table. Again, from a passenger point of view, this sounds horrible, right? It sounds like, you know, we're calling for it. But if you're an investor in one of these airlines or you're running one of these airlines, you really have to take a serious look. Yes, people like to bitch. I'm sorry. People like to complain. And rightly so, because these fees can certainly line up against you. But we have not seen that theoretical maximum point where people start saying, enough, I'm not going to travel anymore. We just haven't seen it. Therefore, it literally is like reaching over and picking a quarter up off the ground and putting it in your pocket. The airlines can keep doing that over and over again. And remember, pre-pandemic, these ancillary fees represented the entire profit margin for the industry, which, of course, was a funny meme out there about that the airlines don't make money hauling passengers. The airlines make money hauling passengers' bags, you know, and there's a little bit of truth to that.
Yeah. Which does that make them a freight company then?
Well, right. I mean, any way they can do that, you know, we've seen it with catering choices. I mean, there's so many different ways they do this, and you're just going to see it more and more. And it's absolutely, just from an industry point of view, it's absolutely a bona fide way to insulate the air, at least the passenger side of the industry, from downturns. I mean, most of these CEOs and CROs, the chief revenue officers at these airlines, they are not fearful of a recession. They're not fearful of fuel prices, and they're not as fearful as labor prices going up like they used to be. Of course, they'll tell you that they are, but the truth is they have tricks. They have a capability to generate revenue they didn't have in the past. And they're able, you know, until it gets to a depression level, they're able to withstand and you know, do that. Now, this doesn't count for the black swan events like, you know, a pandemic. COVID. Yeah, COVID. Or Boeing all of a sudden not being able to meet supply needs. I mean, these are things that were not anticipated, you know, that now are the reality. And they absolutely can be game changers, and they can absolutely disrupt the industry. I would like to think that Boeing is more of a temporary situation, and that, you know, if they have to, they can revert to their lines, their product lines that have been fully certified and have the confidence of the public, you know, and, you know, so they should be able to get back on the, you know, back on their horse, so to speak, and roll out some of these planes that are expected to be delivered in the next couple of years.
Yeah. And going back to the fees real quick, it's, if anyone thought that those fees weren't going to come back, if airlines are just going to give up millions and millions of dollars on a yearly basis, then you were out of your mind. It's like, it's great that you can change for free right now, but maybe it'll be less. I don't know. But in a year or two, they're going to forget about it. You're going to forget about it. You're still going to fly, and you're going to change your flight and hit accept that fee. It just is what it is. There's nothing we can do about it. That's for better or for worse. And you're talking about how they're not fearful of recessions or stuff like that. I would say that they're probably fearful in the way that it affects their return personally or for the company. Yeah, they can find ways to pad more money in there and kind of create more money in revenue, but that's just to keep the same kind of baseline that they have, and their margin gets smaller with that. So maybe they're afraid for that, but they're definitely not as worried as full-on furloughs or Chapter 11 or anything like that.
Yeah, that's probably a better way to say it, Justin, the way you said it. You know, I mean, nobody wants a recession. Nobody's cheering for a recession. No. But, you know, in the old days, pre-ancillary income, you know, by the old days, like the 90s and the 80s, a recession could very much threaten the existence of a company, especially if they were over-leveraged. You know, they had too much debt on the books or whatever the case might be. And sometimes bankruptcy was forced on them, right? You know, somebody that they owe a lot of money to can say, you know what, I don't like how this is looking. They can actually go and force a bankruptcy so they can liquidate their assets. You know, they have to go through a process. But that used to happen with regularity in the airline industry. And so those days, I think, are behind us. But you are absolutely right. You know, profitability, you know, margins, things that are very important to investors and to employees and to companies very well can become compressed.
Yeah, and the pilots with all the profit sharing they got out there.
Especially profit sharing is huge. I mean, people don't realize, especially at the legacy carriers. I mean, you know, this could be substantial. I mean, as a general rule of thumb, you know, give or take, it could be anywhere from 10 to 20% of your yearly salary. So, I mean, just think about that. If you're making $200,000 to $300,000 a year, you get a profit sharing check, you know, of $20,000 to $30,000. You know, it's not bad. Not a bad payday.
And if you got Delta, you multiply that by like four.
Right. Yeah, Delta leads the way. You know, a lot of these other carriers have, a lot of them, American and United are trying to pattern off of that formula. But I still think Delta, just the way they do, just little nuances in their calculations and formulas, it does keep them higher on the profit sharing. I mean, but like I you said, they have the no percentage profit.
Is the same. Say what again? I would say I think the percentage is the same now, but I think American and possibly United share it with more employees. So the pilots have a higher percentage or the same percentage, but share it with less employees. I think they just share it with the pilots.
Yeah, I'd have to look. You very well could be right. I do know that there's some differences in the way it's applied. And so it does tend to be, from a pilot perspective, it tends to be less, right, than what you'd see if you're a pilot at Delta doing the same job. Yep, absolutely. For sure.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I'll have a Delta pilot come on and say that I'm wrong anyway, so it's all good.
That's right.
We're kind of leading into Boeing and what's going on there. Is there any latest at all? I know United deferred the MAX 10s that are kind of not necessarily canceling them, but they're also leasing Airbuses. They're converting more slots and Airbus slots, I believe. I'm sure this is all written in their contract and they had contract protections with Boeing when they did this, but that is not good news for Boeing. You know, it's one thing to not deliver one or two airplanes, but when you're starting to get into multiples and what we're looking at, it is not good for a plane manufacturer and for investors if we're going to keep going that route as well.
Right, right. No, you're right. Well, you know, Boeing's going to fix the problem. I don't know if you heard, and we talked about it, I think, the last time, but they're not going to fix it till January 1st of 2025. I'm kidding. I'm being a little flippant, but the board, many members of the board and the CEO are stepping down. You know, there is a transition period, so they can't just leave tomorrow, but they do need to fix some longstanding obvious problems that they have. It's been well documented, and you can watch the Netflix documentaries or read the message boards. A lot of these things are out there. But you're right, United and other carriers have put protective provisions in the event that, you know, the supply can't be made. You know, if you recall, during the pandemic, the big issue was not a quality issue. The big issue was a supply side. You know, the supply chain was being disrupted. So a lot of those protections that were built into these contracts actually envision problems with delivery, but not because of, you know, regulatory concerns. It was because of, you know, supply side concerns. And so the good news for the airlines is they have all kinds of ways to get out and shift. In the case of United, which you brought up, the easiest way for them to handle this, although they do lose capacity by doing this, but is to convert their MAX 10s back to the MAX 9s, which are, you know, fully certified and right off the assembly line after it goes to acceptances can hit the line, you know, flying. They do lose capacity on that. And so my guess is there's probably, you know, some kind of penalty or a good price break for that. And then, of course, we are seeing, again, United, they're leasing. They're not known to be a big leasing company. They like to buy their own aircraft. So that's a little bit new as well with these Airbuses. But they really needed these Airbuses. And, you know, right now the Airbuses are owned by lots of leasing companies and capital companies, hedge funds. And so if they wanted it, they wanted them, they were going to have to lease them. And so that's what they're doing. So, yeah, you're going to see a shift. And this will be something that'll ripple through Boeing for a while in terms of their value. You know, I mean, they're going to lose out quite a bit here through penalties and through, you know, issues with delivery, not delivering the product that they thought they'd deliver. You know, they still have, a bona fide 787 line. You know, they have a military freighter tanker contracts that are very lucrative. So, I mean, the company itself is going to be okay, but they do have to fix these issues with the 737. You know, you don't want the 737 to get the same tagline associated with it, like the DC-10 did, you know, where it just people start. I mean, I'm sure you get questions from friends and family, hey, I'm flying on a MAX today. Am I okay? I mean, I get those.
It was just a 737 in general. They're like, hey, I'm a 737. Yep. It's like, I assume you will be okay. Yes. Yeah. Right now is probably the safest time, especially if you're worried about the door because they fastened all those bolts.
Yeah. I don't think that door's going anywhere. Yeah.
No, so that door's not going anywhere.
No. So yeah, I agree. You know, and I think my opinion, and I sent you a link to an analysis I did. I do think some of the stuff we're seeing in the news media, it is over emphasizing some of these maintenance issues, and it is that's fine. The news media can report what they want to report, but the problem is it is causing lots of concern, and you know, it's scaring the public in some cases. You know, I mean, legitimate issue to talk about the 737 MAX 10. You know, the door popping off. You know, a few weeks on the line. These are legitimate things to talk about, but then reaching into on this flight on this day there was a a wheel fell off on landing. I mean, yeah, you don't want to see that. But I mean, you know, there's thousands and thousands of flights each day. There are going to be little hiccups. The crews have handled it just fine. You know, I mean, I read a story about a panel missing on a plane the other day. You know, the truth is I had a panel missing on one of the planes I flew back in the day. I mean, again, not something you want, you know, but I mean, you know, the plane's going to fly. It's, you know, but the public doesn't know that. They think everything's antiseptic and perfect and everything's operating. I mean, if you ever really want to scare a passenger, explain what an MEL is. Go to a passenger and explain what an MEL is. Yeah, we don't always have to have every system working. Start with your explanation of that and see how that goes. They will not understand that. That'll absolutely increase trepidation and fear. You know, I mean, just think about that. I mean, to us, it's a way of operation. Okay, yeah, that's deferred. All right, great. We can fly it for another 3 hours, whatever. I can ferry it, whatever the case may be. Passengers don't think that way. Everything works on that plane.
Yep. You'd be surprised. You would be surprised.
Right.
Let's take a break from today's episode to hear from our sponsor, RAA. Hey, Justin here. Ever wonder if your investments are soaring or falling short while you're busy conquering new heights? Introducing RAA's free investment goal calculator. It's more than just numbers. It's clarity on your financial journey. Get a clear snapshot of your current standing and chart the best path forward to your goals. Whether you're a seasoned investor or new to finance, this tool is a game changer. Check out RAA's free investment goal calculator at raa.com/pilot to pilot. That's raa.com/pilot to pilot. And now back to today's episode.
I think another thing about the media too, and unfortunately, I'm going to say it's kind of necessary in this moment because that's the only way things change in aviation, right? It's either the big incident where it kills the wrong family member or the Congress member or the Senate member, someone of prominence, but it takes a lot of pressure to make a change in the FAA, in Boeing, in aviation in general. So I do think it's over sensationalized. And I do think they are nitpicking on everything that's going on. And like you said, it's just a normal day in aviation sometimes. Now, not doors flying off. We don't want that.
Right.
But every day there's an emergency.
Yeah. Well, I think you're right. I mean, absolutely. That's going to get a lot of concern focused. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with going through a process that, you know, helps us behave better as an industry. You know, on the other side of that, of course, you know, is you'd hate to see if the regulators step in and they start, you know, buying into some of it. And by the way, I don't blame the news media, right? They're businesses in some cases. And they're gonna publish stories that people click on and read, right? And you can't blame them because that's their business model. And the public loves, and they always have, they love aviation safety things. It's like their cup of tea, man. And anything that might go wrong, they're gonna click on that article over and over and over again. It's unlike almost any other industry I know of. I mean, you know, never mind, you know, all the people that die in car accidents or other things like that, which are tragic. You know, if a panel falls off a plane, you know, 100 million people are going to know about it, you know, by the time it lands. So I don't blame them for that because it generates a lot of interest. But to your larger point, as long as the people that should know better, like the regulators and the people that are constantly monitoring for real trends, because we do have real trends that come up every now and then, right? Mm-hmm. And so as long as the regulators are looking at that, and you know, the union safety folks, the company safety folks. As long as they're all plugged in, which I have seen no evidence that they are not, everything is still fully functioning there. I just don't want to see an overreaction where all of a sudden the government tries to overregulate for political reasons rather than for safety reasons. Such a fine line, though, right? And again, I'm with you. Nothing wrong with putting a spotlight on certain things. Hoping that it helps puts the industry through a little bit of a crucible, but when they emerge from the other end, you know, they're better for it and we're all better for it.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. I think there's definitely a fine line of going too far and maybe not over sensationalize everything, but that could also be maybe get a quality airline reporter on your staff and run it by them first and be like, hey, is this a big deal? And be like, no. Right. And be like, all right, cool, thanks.
Right. Will it get clicks?
Yeah. Yeah. Really no idea when that's going to change. You know, we don't know. United seems to think it's going to be the summertime, maybe a couple months, and then after that, they should be all good to go. But that doesn't mean the MAX 10 is going to be certified. That just might mean that they have everything else kind of going up. I almost feel like the MAX 10 could be a ways away. You know, that's going to be a couple of years out, most likely.
Well, the FAA is in no hurry, right? They're in no hurry to get that thing certified, because the worst thing that could absolutely happen is a MAX 10 hits the line with an FAA blessing. And, you know, in an airline acceptance, an airline says, yeah, everything's perfectly fine. And we see something happen again, like the door blowing off. And so that would cause, you know, absolute criticality with confidence from the public. So it's the FAA has shown before with the MAX issues, they are in absolutely no hurry to rush through any type of a certification of it. So I know some of the certification folks that sit in the different parts of the FAA. They are generally often very brilliant engineers. So, you know, I'm glad in one sense that, you know, they're not having pressure put on them to get these planes certified and out the door. But I also know just the way the FAA works in general, you know, it's not a fast moving, you know, mm-hmm. If you ever have to get like a waiver for something for your airline, it's going to take a while. It's got to go through public comment. It's got to go through different kinds of things. And the same thing's going to happen here. I think it's just by its nature, it's going to be slow. Then you add to it some of the concern and some of the ramifications, political ramifications. I think that's going to exacerbate the length. So I think a couple of years would be a good result.
Yeah, which is just crazy.
That is.
If I'm the FAA or if I'm the government, I go to Boeing, like, look, we need some good news, please. Can you just like get a CAD drawing of a 797? Just like show us something of like that you're doing something in the future, that we're getting something new. It's like, just please give us something.
Right.
You know? It's like, we want some hope that this is, there's a new aircraft coming sometime soon that you can kind of step away from the 737, which has seemed to become a problem child for you.
Yeah. And you know, the 737, there's a lot of questions out there. And I don't fly the 737, but I know a lot of pilots that will talk about this. You know, they keep stretching it, right? And then of course it changes all the aerodynamic principles, including where the wings are and the center of lift, the center of pressure, all the stuff you used to learn about when you're going through flight school, you know, all the different aerodynamic things. And so it's like, are we trying to force something, you know, that isn't, you know, that maybe should have just gone through a full redesign, you know, from scratch? Of course, that's extremely expensive. And, you know, when you can just kind of keep adding models, becomes a little bit easier to certify it. You know, it's common with the other pilots. So whether, you know, it's a common fleet, you know, type rating. So, I mean, and you know, even maintenance, there's a lot of things that are shared. So, you know, there's a lot of pressure to keep reinventing the current fleet types because, you know, for all the reasons I just said, there's a lot of efficiencies there. And so, yeah, I don't know. The 797 and some of the other stuff I think would be fantastic. I don't know if you're going to, you know, I don't know from a PR point of view, when and if Boeing's going to think it's a good time to release that. You know, they usually do it at some of the air shows, like the Paris air show is a big one, Oshkosh. Some of those they'll often put out announcements, you know, that kind of makes a splash. So we'll keep an eye on that at some of these upcoming shows and see what happens.
Absolutely. All right, moving on. I don't want to bash Boeing too much. Right. Not a good business decision, so I'm not going to be doing that. We talked a little bit about ALPA. They put out an Instagram post with multiple airline CEOs, and it started with the Mesa one, talking about how there is no, I think he, I don't know if it was, this isn't a quote for quote, but he was talking about how he has no shortage of airlines or regional airline FO applications. I think that's what he said.
Yeah.
And then went on to talk with multiple other airline CEOs or prominent people in the industry that were more or less agreeing with that and kind of just saying they don't really see a shortage. They have plenty of this, plenty of that. We have talked a little bit about how there is a shortage. I think we would both agree that there is a pilot shortage still. It's just going through a kind of a wave inside of itself. Most notably, the regionals need captains very bad. You've said that. I know that's been talked about a million times before. They may have caught up a little bit on the FO side. And I, from what I've heard, getting hired at a regional, you could sit and wait a while for training because training's backed up a lot. So that may be true, but I just want to have new applicants kind of be aware that they're still hiring. They're still going to hire. There's still the opportunity to get to a major. And just looking at retirement numbers, it's still going to happen. It's funny that we got to say this every single time because, you know, just reading one Instagram post or one form or anything like that, someone could say that the shortage is over. And in your brain, you're like, I don't know why I quit my job to be a pilot. It's over. Like, why'd I do that? So I think it's important to still share that and talk about that.
Yeah, I agree because I get those same questions. And, you know, look, we have seen some record hiring in the past couple of years. We are seeing a little bit of a slowdown. But what's funny, when I say that, it makes it sound like there's some kind of major problem with the, you know, with potential hiring in the future. And there really isn't, because historically, we're still seeing some, you know, very robust hiring by historical standards. You know, as I mentioned before, a good year for hiring, if you would hire 3,000 to 5,000 pilots across all the major airlines, that would have been an amazing year, you know. And, you know, over the past couple of years, we've seen 25,000 pilots hired at the same carrier, which is just, you know, that's a ridiculous amount of pilots. So yeah, we may not see that for the next year or two. But as you say, the retirements have not kicked in at all these carriers, the crux of them. And so you're going to see replacement there. Also, every fundamental forecast out there for passenger growth, there, I haven't seen a single one that calls for any kind of a decline. All of it is arrows green, you know, for the foreseeable future. People are going to continue to fly as the world population increases. You're going to see more and more people fly. So growth is going to be there as well. So yeah, again, though, I would caution anybody, you know, that comes in the industry, you want to be in this industry because it's your passion and that's what you want to do. You want to fly an airplane, which, you know, is a righteous job. You know, it's a great job, but there might be some ebb and flow to it. You know, we look at the regional FO, that is the easier one to hire, right? That's a, you know, if you get through a restricted ATP program, you can get someone there at 1,000 hours, you know, and, you know, actually the airlines used to have it figured out down to how much sim time you'd get in training. So they'd hire you at like 985 or, you know, 978 or whatever their profile was, because they knew you'd have that 1,000 hours for the restricted ATP at the end of it. So those folks are still there. There's no doubt. Yes, it is a regional captain issue because, you know, we know that because the huge bonuses are still being offered for those regional captains to come and fly. The only thing I'm going to say about ALPA, because, you know, I'm a former MEC chairman and, you know, I consider ALPA, you know, a fantastic organization. There's a little bit of gamesmanship, and, you know, I applaud it as being a former negotiator and someone that used to be in the thick of the fight. So, you know, the fact that they're quoting, airline CEOs and some airline CEOs that have in the past had a little bit of a notorious relationship with their union labor groups. And the fact that ALPA is saying, look what this CEO is saying about this thing, they agree. We agree. It's a little bit of a thumb in the face from ALPA to the regional industry, in particular the RAA, not to be confused with, you know, your RAA, back in the Regional Airline Association, who have had, and I've been in the room when the Regional Airline Association has talked to the ALPA folks, and it is interesting to watch the play go back and forth. They are very much opposed on many issues. So the fact that ALPA is, and make no mistake, the Regional Airline Association is staffed by airline CEOs. That's who sits on the RAA council. So it's interesting when they say, you know, here's Jonathan Ornstein from Mesa Airlines CEO, who's been a longstanding CEO. He's had in the past, he's had people say that, you know, he's been really tough on labor. I'll let people decide that, you know, but now ALPA's using him to say, hey, there's no issue here. You know, I just find it just a fascinating turn of events. And this industry is rapidly becoming something that strange bedfellows, things that you thought you'd never see before. You're starting to see a little bit of that. So again, something will play out. Again, for people that are looking at getting in the industry long-term, you can't look at this over 6 months. You can't even look at it over a year, year and a half. If you look at it over 30, 35, 40 years, it's a great industry. There's going to be ample opportunity. It's a little bit of ebb and flow. You know, it may not quite be as easy all the time as it has been for the last 3 years, but it'll still be relatively easy compared to how it's been over the last, you know, 15 to 20 years for most. So Again, get in the industry though, because you're passionate about it and it's what you want to do.
Yeah. Ditto. Well said.
you and I both said that a few times, I think.
We'll say it again every single time too. It's a tough industry, man. It is. You'll lose your love of aviation. You'll lose your love of flying. At some point, you want to not do something in your training period and you want to quit and do something else. But if you stick it out, you know, the love comes back. The money comes and goes and comes again. And who knows, it might go again. But something crazy is always going to happen. So you just got to be prepared for it. You got to try your best to save for those rainy days and just enjoy it while you can. Yeah. Enjoy your long overnights, because you're going to get a short you're going to get short overnight pretty quickly after that. Yeah. That's a good
great analogy. Yeah. Well said.
Yeah. We can kind of wrap up here in a little bit, but we want to kind of touch up with anything new with Spirit, or I know we kind of mentioned beforehand that they did get some money from Pratt with all their engine issues, but is there anything else going on with potential bankruptcy or any other rumblings that you've heard?
I haven't heard bankruptcy mentioned. You know, it's interesting to bring up Pratt. You know, everyone's beaten up on Boeing recently. You know, the other company that hasn't been faring so well is Pratt & Whitney with some of these engine issues, you know. And so, you know, they're thankful. I think Pratt's thankful for Boeing. It's kind of their lightning rod. But if Boeing wasn't having their issues right now, we'd be having lots of conversations about these engines and, you know, their reliability. Yeah. And they're paying out a lot of warranty claims, or in some cases just settlements to the different carriers. In the case of Spirit, they're collecting anywhere from 150 to 200 million. Now, is that going to be something that, you know, makes them profitable this year? No, it's compensation for things that went wrong. So in theory, it's making them whole. But, you know, it's an interesting development. And again, not something I've been familiar with in the past. Yes, there's been warranty claims, but it's never really been on a full line before. You know, it's just usually been on like one-offs. I remember when the first Embraer 145s came out of Embraer, and I think Continental Express, or the old, you know, prior to ASA, they were one of the first operators. They had all, anytime you're the launch customer of a brand new airframe, you know, you go through some serious growing pains. Yeah.
Never goes well.
And yeah. So they were really just, you know, paying out warranty claims left and right. I mean, I'm sure it took years before they ever saw a profit on that line. So, but once they get it going, once they get it dialed in and they know what's going to break so they can fix it before it breaks, they get it dialed in like that, then things go pretty well. And so, you know, so we would see stuff like that, but we'd never see, like, all of a sudden Pratt saying, oh yeah, my bad. You know, we do have these structural things. Sometimes you'd see a batch, right? Like maybe there was a batch of engines or a batch of some kind of component or APUs or whatever, where they got bad metal or it wasn't forged correctly, or even in some severe cases, somehow some counterfeit parts made their way in the supply chain. And, you know, the FAA really cracks down on that now, and rightly so. But things like that could happen in the past. But it would never be like widespread, like, you know, hey, all your Pratt engines, you're going to get paid for them, you know, for inspection. So yeah, it's just, you know, I feel bad for Spirit. It's not a good time for them. It's still up in the air on what JetBlue is going to remunerate them. You know, my guess is I'm sure that'll head to court, and some judge somewhere will probably say, this is what you have to pay. I mean, that's just the cynical part of me. And, you know, I've been in the industry for a while, but we'll see, you know. And JetBlue is going through issues too. Well, not issues, but they're going through realignment now as well, by, you know, reducing the West Coast. And, you know, and you and I were talking beforehand, you know, with their ETOPS, they're trying to expand their markets. And, you know, I think we were talking about their first flight had an engine failure. Everything was fine. You know, the crew handled it. ETOPS is designed to have plans for that. We don't know all the details of it yet, but, you know, that's not an auspicious start to, you know, a North Atlantic track route.
Yeah. For an Airbus, one of the very first flights for that specific airplane that they had. Right. Didn't really fare too well.
No, so, bad luck. But, you know, great crews there as well. And they handled things exactly the way they were supposed to handle them. Really a non-event, but it's just kind of, it's a bummer to see that on your first time out for that, or one of your first times.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And it just doesn't help with, the media is over-sensationalizing everything that we talked about before. So that is something that they can, it's kind of important to have two engines when you're flying over the ocean. You know, maybe important's not the right word, but it makes you feel more comfortable.
Makes you feel more comfortable. Well, I remember I was talking to a New York Times reporter once, and she wanted me to explain to her what ETOPS was. And I should have never said this. And I said, Well, it stands for, you know, engine turns or pilot swims, right? That's the old acronym. She goes, really? I go, oh, no. I go, that's just a joke. I said, some people say engine turns or passenger swims, but no, that's not, it's extended, you know, overwater operation. You know, I go into the, and I begged her not to put my name to that in the New York Times. Just say, please don't say Jim Higgins calls this engine turns or pilot swims. But I mean, it does kind of have kind of like, you know, at the, you know, it does kind of explain it, right? But with the reliability of these engines, and I saw that there have been some, who was it? Somebody got approved for, maybe it was JetBlue, but I thought there was somebody else that got approved for a more lengthy ETOS. It was 180 minutes, I think, for an Airbus, which is really pushing it's really pushing the envelope to be away from, 180 over the water, 180 minutes. Somebody got that recently. You know, and
it may have been JetBlue. I remember reading that, but I don't remember who the actual airline itself is.
I don't either. But still, it goes to show you that you know, the reliability is still very high with these engines, even though we're talking about some of the stuff. Otherwise, they would never get these kinds of approvals. It's all based on data-driven decision-making. You know, the FAA is going to sit there and say, okay, the odds of an engine failing, you know, for this Pratt on this aircraft is whatever. They have the number, right? One in, 3 million hours or whatever. Maybe that's extreme, but you know, the point is, okay, so then what's the odds of both of them? Well, I mean, it is apart from, you know, weird events like fuel contamination or things that can affect both, similarly poor maintenance on both engines, whatever the scenarios might be, but just the fact that two regularly maintained engines that they would both quit in the same flight, you know, they're astronomical odds. I mean, we as pilots, you know, some airframes carry the dual engine flameout procedure, but many don't, or they do, but it's not a memory item, or it's something that's buried deep in the QRH or whatever the case may be, because it just doesn't happen, right? And so these numbers are well known. The odds are well known by the FAA and by the people that grant these waivers. You know what the risk is. You know, and so the truth is, there's not much of a risk to it. You know, these planes, the biggest risk, I think, is just a passenger convenience risk. You know, being on a 737 or an Airbus or any narrow body, for 8 to 10 hours, that's a long time to be on one.
It's a long time, very long time. Right. And they're not going as high as the other ones are either. So you're kind of right in the crappy weather. Yeah. You're really affected by winds. So maybe that's where they needed the 180 minutes for it. So I don't know. We'll see. A lot's still going on there. Yeah. Last couple thing. What all is going on with JetBlue? Like it's crazy how fast things can change in a couple months. You know, we're going to merge with Spirit. We're really going to seem that we want to try to battle with the big four. We want to be up there. The Spirit merger doesn't go through. Looks like Spirit's falling apart. And now it looks like JetBlue is getting rid of some of their West Coast flying. And it's just really interesting. You know, what once seemed like we finally did it. We're finally going to be up in the upper echelon with these other airlines. And now it's, all right, we got to pull back this flying. We got to focus on what made us profitable in the first place. And is most of the East Coast. Most of the East Coast flying.
Right, right. That's where they cut their teeth, the East Coast. You know, great question about JetBlue. They do have new leadership. They have a new CEO. They have a new, I believe, COO, or at least a VP of ops. Whenever you bring in a new group, one of the first things they're going to do is they're going to assess things. They're going to say, okay, where are my margins? You know, what are my issues? You know, and if the West Coast, and I get asked this every now and then, well, you know, the planes are full. Why aren't they increasing service there? They'll fill these planes up. There's a lot more to it than just filling up a plane, right? There's a concept known as opportunity cost. My guess is, and these folks are very smart at this, that the revenue functions, the people that run the revenue at these airlines, extremely gifted mathematicians, MIT type grads, you know, really, really smart people. They're going to take a look and they're going to say, okay, yeah, this is the margin on this. You know, we've got we make 3 cents RASM, right? Revenue per available seat mile on this route. But if I pull that plane out of there and I put it on this East Coast route, you know, all of a sudden it's 4 cents. Okay, an extra cent, right? How big of a deal it is. Well, if I start doing that with all these other markets on the East Coast, pretty soon, and then, by the way, I can reduce my infrastructure and I don't have to keep my operational spares deployed on the West Coast, because there's nothing worse. I don't know if you knew this, but a typical airline has about 13% of their aircraft sitting on shelves. And that's a very expensive amount of inventory not producing revenue for the company. And so when they look at things like that, those are the kind of things they look at. Well, if I don't have to have all these spares on the West Coast, I don't have my engines out there, my full-blown, ready-to-go spare, I can move more assets localized. it may make real good sense to make a little more money, reduce your costs, to say, yeah, I think we'll still go to the West Coast. We'll still have some flights. We're going to de-emphasize. We're going to de-hub there a little bit and redeploy where there's better opportunity. And that's the concept of opportunity cost. I do trust that the JetBlue folks have run all their numbers on this. My guess is a new team came in. Maybe it was planned before they came in, but a new team came in and they're executing that plan. And I don't think it's the rumors of the merger, you know, which we talked about before, like merging with somebody. I mean, you never know. They've obviously shown an appetite for merging, but you know, it might be a while before they try again, right? They're 0-2 in their last two ones. And so I think that's what's going on there, is you're seeing just, you know, a new analysis done for route structure, and some decisions are being made to hopefully redeploy and get more opportunity.
That's interesting. That's a good way to look at that. I guess I really wasn't really aware of the new leadership that came in there. That makes a lot of sense with, hey, we can make blah, blah, blah with this. And when you talk about merger, I don't think the reason the Spirit merger went through was because of LAX. You know, it was probably because of the Northeast routes and the East Coast routes. So doubling down on that doesn't make sense to go buy another, buy someone else. So yeah, it's definitely profitability. It's definitely what they think they can do. And I mean, they moved from Long Beach. I think Long Beach was pretty much the focus city and moved it all to LAX, and now kind of reducing that as well. So it's always kind of been an interesting play for them, because when I think of JetBlue, I think of Boston, I think of the Northeast, and I think of Florida.
Right.
So West Coast isn't necessarily all I think of it. And they've tried to break it out there, right? Wasn't it Virgin? JetBlue wanted Virgin, and then they didn't get Virgin, so then they started doing it their own.
Right. That's exactly what happened. Yeah. That's one of the issues with like the JetBlue, which in my opinion was built pretty closely to the Southwest, which makes sense, of course, because Neilman that founded them just followed that blueprint. The big knock, and you know, Southwest has figured out how to keep doing it, but the big knock on that, again, just from a strategy point of view, strategic point of view, is how are they going to grow, right? You have a single airframe. How are you going to go? Well, we're seeing it through ETOPS and things like that. But in JetBlue's case, you know, they had the East Coast covered apparently. And so how are you going to grow? Well, you still got this entire section of the United States and, you know, of course, Canada, Mexico, other places like that, that you can grow into. And so that's what they're trying to do. But I have to trust that they've done their calculations. I don't sense any financial trouble there at all. I think it's just literally a strategic decision on how they're going to deploy their assets. And who knows, maybe they come back, you know, and grow the West Coast organically. You know, they keep track of their frequent flyers and they have really good data on that. And when they see it get to a certain tipping point again, they're like, okay, we're going to mini hub that, or we're going to, you know, run a bank, you know, to connect different things. Yeah.
I don't know. You don't know, but I do know that they know. They have smart people, and they seem to have a plan. So I guess we'll see. Well, time will tell. Who knows? Maybe the surprise be like, hey, we're buying blah, blah, blah. But time will tell.
Yeah.
But that's pretty much all I got today, Jim. Thanks for coming on. I appreciate it. As always, it's great to hear what you have to say and what you know, because like we said earlier, it's a lot. It's good for you to come on and share information. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, Justin. It's always good to be here. I like talking to your audience. I do get lots of emails from them. Sometimes I can't always get to all of them. Sometimes they're very detailed questions, but some of the stuff I get is pretty interesting. And I'm glad that people are finding this useful. I mean, you and I could probably talk about this for days. And I'm always happy to talk about it. And I appreciate the opportunity to come back on.
Absolutely. Maybe we'll start taking your emails and putting them on and answering some questions.
Yeah, great.
The wildest email that Jim has.
Well, maybe not that one.
Well, cool. Well, Jim, thank you so much. I hope you have a good night. We'll see you soon.
Thanks, Justin. Nice talking with you.
Yeah, you too.
That's a wrap on episode 304 of the Pilot to Pilot podcast. Like I said earlier, some of the information is old because of the Spirit news and with UPS hiring. So bear with us there. We will have another episode out here soon coming out, and we will update you with what we can. But Aviation, hope you're having a great day. And as always, happy flying.
Pilot to Pilot LLC is compensated to make recommendations to his or her followers regarding the services of RAA or Allworth Airline Advisors, companies of Allworth Financial, LP, or Allworth. Promoter is not an employee or investment advisor representative of Allworth. Promoter is a current client of Allworth. Allworth pays promoter a fee of $4,000 a month for sponsorship of the Pilot to Pilot podcast. Due to the compensation arrangement between Allworth and promoter, promoter has an incentive to recommend Allworth, resulting in material conflict of interest. Promoter's role on behalf of Allworth is limited strictly to making recommendations regarding the services of Allworth, introducing or referring prospective clients to Allworth. Promoter has no responsibility with respect to Allworth's investment advisor or other advisory services.